Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Money Talking from WNYC. I'm Charlie Herman. Are some of the world's biggest international banks guilty of terrorism? Well, that is the accusation in a lawsuit filed in Brooklyn against HSBC, Credit Suisse, Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland, and Standard Chartered. Paul Barrett is a reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he wrote about the suit for this week's issue of the magazine. And Paul, what is the argument that connects these banks and bankers with terrorist acts that have killed Americans?
Yeah. Well, if it sounds far-fetched, it's because it is. This is a stretch, and that's where you have to start. And even the advocates of this lawsuit, the main lawyer, Gary Olson, will admit that he's on the cutting edge of liability here. So here's how the causal chain goes. These large multinational banks have done business with Iranian banks. That's been documented. And in fact, they've been penalized by the U.S. government for violating sanctions barring dealings with Iran. The Iranian banks, in turn, have moved money for organizations like the Islamic Revolutionary Guard in Iran and Hezbollah, the Lebanese-based Shia militant group that Iran backs. Those groups, in turn, have trained and armed Shia militant groups in Iraq, which have been responsible for terrorism that has resulted in the deaths of hundreds of American soldiers and civilians.
Can you make that connection that the money that these banks were touching, that it went from one account to the next account and ended up in Hezbollah? Or is this just a situation of saying, look, you settled with the Department of Justice over these accusations and have basically, you've revealed emails that you did dealings. It doesn't matter the specific dollar that went from one place to another. You were involved.
Yeah. That latter argument is in a slightly more verbose form will be largely what the banks will be arguing, that this is a question of government regulation. This is a question of policing. And they have been policed and they have, in fact, agreed to what are known as deferred prosecution agreements, whereby criminal charges have been brought against them. The charges have not been pursued. They've been deferred, and the banks have agreed to reform themselves. And they, in fact, have not denied wrongdoing in connection with these deals. However, Gary Olson wants to sort of connect the dots all the way out to the battlefield. And whether he can do that, whether the law he has invoked, which is called the anti-terrorism law, provides for that kind of expansive liability is the question in the case. And it sounds far-fetched, but Gary Olson is a lawyer to be reckoned with. And just last September, he won a trailblazing jury verdict in the same federal court that he's suing in now in Brooklyn, New York, where he held one of the largest banks in the Middle East, Arab Bank, liable for the bank's financial relationships with members of Hamas. So now he wants to go an even a further step because Arab Bank had direct relationships with leaders of Hamas. Now he wants to hold liable banks that do not have direct relationships with Hezbollah or with the Revolutionary Guard, but have indirect relationships through Iranian financial institutions. So he's pushing the law further and further, stretching it further and further. If he gets to a jury, he's going to be in good shape because then it's a question of terrorism victims versus faceless banks. And obviously, in that situation, he has a structural advantage.
How are the banks responding to these lawsuits?
In my preliminary interviews with the banks that would talk to me, and most of them won't even talk to me yet, they have said largely a version of what you said at the top of the segment, which is, look, we've had our problems in the past. We didn't monitor these things as closely as we should have. But you can't spin out from that a theory where we are responsible for death and destruction. So this is a whole new area. And what we're seeing is it's the classic American process of litigation, sort of testing the boundaries of who can be held culpable for bad behavior.
Paul, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Recently, I've been talking with authors for the Harvard Business Review about how you can thrive or maybe just survive at work. And one thing that often gets in our way are coworkers.
When you want to be more productive and more effective at work, you can't ever frame it as you people are bothering me, stop.
Dori Clark is a business professor at Duke University, and she says that too often we get trapped in responding to what other people need when they need it.
I think most people are not thinking about the impact of their actions on other people. So they are, in fact, wasting our time, not because they're malicious, not because they're trying to do a power play generally, but simply because they're not that focused on how to make life better for you. They're doing their own thing. And if we want to fix that, we have to try to impose a structure so that they are more respectful of our time.
But you can't really block out the world when you're at work. So how do you limit your time being wasted by other people?
There are some simple things that you can do. One really easy one that I suggest to people is insisting on an agenda for meetings. And obviously, if you're the boss, it's pretty easy to do that. If you're lower down on the totem pole, you have to argue for it a little bit, but it is actually really hard to lose an argument if you're raising your hand and saying, guys, I have an idea for how we can make this whole meeting far more efficient.
But is there ever a danger that by trying to like set an agenda or trying to be really focused that you might miss those kind of conversations where you learn something interesting or you have an idea that's sparked?
The role of serendipity in business is critically important. And it is something that, because of the heavy scheduling of our own lives, has in a lot of ways been engineered out. If you are in 8 back-to-back meetings throughout your workday, there's not a lot of time for serendipity. But that doesn't mean that it should be creeping in the midst of a meeting where you're really trying to accomplish something else. That is a distraction. What I suggest instead is that people should try to limit their structured, scheduled things on their calendar, like meetings, and then leave larger blocks of time for those types of discoveries and fortuitous conversations.
What's the end goal out of all this? What are you trying to accomplish if you are successful in finding ways to limit your time being wasted?
There are a lot of reasons why we need to protect our time and stop it from being wasted. A big one is our overall life satisfaction and work-life balance. If people are consistently wasting your time during the workday, that work still needs to get done. Also, it's about optimizing the bottom line for our companies.
Dori Clark is the author of Stop People from Wasting Your Time. You can find a link to the article at our website, moneytalking.org. And while you're there, check out our other conversations about life in the workplace, or just subscribe to the podcast, available for free on iTunes. I'm Charlie Herman, and this is Money Talking from WNYC.